I want some money. Yeah.
Welcome to Razor's Edge, Sydney's independent and local current affairs. I'm Miles Holbrook-Walk. Today on the show...
In 2001, the September 11 attacks on New York City, which, in addition to the sexual predator stereotype, turned us all into terrorist suspects.
Barney, the protagonist in Michael Muhammad Ahmed's new novel The Lebs, is a teenager at Punchbowl Boys High School in Sydney's West. Set during the turn of the century, Ahmed explores what it's like growing up a Muslim in Sydney's post-9/11 society. Also, coming up later on the show...
We're near Sydney, actually closer to a town called Gosford.
Seeking Sydney is back, and today producer Victor Petrovich heads out to debunk one of the most mysterious and controversial sites on the New South Wales Central Coast, the Gosford Hieroglyphs. But first...
They were rushing back into the cinema and they were going, Wakanda forever!
A pair of Indigenous activists have brought Wakanda, the fictional African country featured in Marvel Comics' Black Panther, to the Redfern community. Hoping to enjoy and imagine what a thriving, uncolonised black society and culture would look like, Lorna Munro and Kaya Abwaji held a free community screening of the new Black Panther right here in Sydney on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. I want to start on the idea of having a screening of Black Panther in Australia, what the actual intention of the screening was and what the idea about it was.
The idea to do a community screening really started between a conversation on Facebook between Lorna
like
and
good
I.
Things start.
It was prompted by a post I think Lorna had seen earlier about the one that was done in Melbourne to enable access for Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islander and black youth to go and see the film. We noticed that there wasn't anything of a similar nature being done in Sydney. Mm. So that's, I think, was the catalyst for your initial post, and I responded to it.
Mm.
It grew into a larger conversation about some of the themes in it as well, like the role of the black women in that movie and the role of organising and taking initiative for community healing, community empowerment, and some of the positive things that this movie has proven to be for.
We just had a talk about, you know, how important it was to contextualise it for our youth, to not just to get caught up in that buzz, but yes, to get caught up in it, but also be really reflecting what they're talking about within this space that we are in and our country. And when I say our country, I mean like in an Aboriginal context. I mean, you know, the 600 and something different nations that make up this country.
I want to ask a little bit about the film of Black Panther. Obviously, you've both seen it, but there will be some people who haven't. Some of the ideas in this film, can you talk to me a little bit about them and why I thought it was significant to have a community screening of the nature that you guys had organised to watch a film like Black Panther?
The biggest thing for us as young Aboriginal people in this country is the revolutionary act of imagining what life can be like without colonisation. When we talk about, you know, oppressed people, that alone is just mind-blowing concept, that a lot of us from colonised countries actually have to go, hold on a minute, that's huge. You know, so I think any kind of film and any kind of catalyst, any kind of art that can kind of provoke these thoughts for our young people, I think, is exactly what we need right now.
Yeah, I would like to just extend on that. The role of the Afrofuturism, which is the aesthetic that is used in the film, looking at it's like a mix of sci-fi and art, I think it was really important in conveying a message to children and young people that our emancipation is in our art and in our culture.
You described a nuanced racism in Australia and the way that it's targeted towards Aboriginal Australians. What do you think some of the... What is different, I suppose, about the racism that's perpetuated in Australia?
The huge difference, and I have to bring it back to, is the historical context and the way that this country was founded on dispossession of our people and on genocide and on pretty much the dehumanisation of our people. And by the time that colonisation reached these shores, the tools of colonisation were really fine-tuned because they had time to practice on the Americas, they had time to practice on the African countries, they had time to practice and finesse their tools. And basically, when we look at the reason why Australia was founded, it was has a lot to do with the story of the Americas and their independence. And the colony needed a new piggy bank, pretty much. So, you know, we talk about all these things. A lot of people don't like to refer to what happened in this country and the genocide and the slavery that happened in this country as slavery. And I think a lot of the racism that we experience today goes back to the dehumanization and the forms of slavery, the forms of eugenics that were played out here, apartheid as well, all of these huge things that the world has learnt from white people in Australia on how to solve the Aboriginal problem.
Are you guys open to doing more community screenings in the future, like the one that you you did on Friday?
This morning, my son has seen it for the second time through that community screening, and this morning he was, before school, he was on YouTube, Google looking for who the actual the Dora tribe, the women warriors, he was actually looking for the real ones, asking me, can you show me what they actually look like in real life? So it's already sparked his interest in exploring the diversity within the continent of Africa, not just Ghana, where we come from. So I can see that that is a direct outcome of him seeing those that warrior warrior group in the film. That is a direct outcome of him saying, at a subconscious level, looking at, oh, who are these people and what were they really about in real life?
What we did and what we are trying to do is much needed. Our young people are, you know, over-policed. They're stigmatised every single day. They're stereotyped by the way that they talk, what they wear, you know, the schools that they go to. I think that it was, you know, invaluable to be able to have a room full of young people in a safe space to be able to sit down and really aim for the stars, you know, and really think about those huge dreams that they would love to be able to make reality one day.
Lorna and Kaya ending that story. I'm Miles Holbrook-Walk, and you're listening to Razor's Edge. Just 1 hour north of Sydney and just outside Gosford in Carryong, there are almost 300 engravings on two sandstone walls. And some believe these writings, these hieroglyphs in fact, are an example of an early form of Egyptian writing. They've long been dismissed as fakes by authorities and academics since their discovery in the 1970s. But there are still ongoing attempts to prove the theory they were carved by the ancient Egyptians. Viktor Petrovich has more.
We're near Sydney, actually closer to a town called Gosford.
We are on a pretty busy highway here. Now, we're not sure even if this is the right way at the moment, but we're going to obviously go down here to the fork where you go left.
Deep in the Brisbane Water National Park, a few kilometres from the outer Gosford suburb of Carryong, lies a curious set of rock carvings which have sparked widespread debate not only in the local community, but all the way to Egypt.
And then you go 300 metres down there, and then it's on your left again, apparently, and then you have to hunt around for them, so hopefully we'll find them.
So you want to go down there?
OK. Oh my gosh.
I am at the just outside Carryong, 3 kilometres out of Carryong, and I'm in a bushland setting that's it's unmarked on any maps.
I'm just here at the Gosford glyphs, or the Carryong glyphs, or the Waiwai glyphs, whichever you'd like to pronounce them.
It is the site of an Egyptian burial of an Egyptian prince.
The site lies about an hour's trek from Woi Woi Road, if you know what you're looking for, Spanning over the surface of a group of large boulders are a set of what seems like ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs. First discovered in 1970, the glyphs have sparked widespread debate over their origins and their meaning. Experts and enthusiasts from far and wide have travelled to Karyong to get a glimpse of the famous Gosford glyphs. But what do they mean, and why are they there? This is Seeking Sydney, where we answer the questions you have about your city. I'm Victor Petrovich, and this week I've been looking into a set of mysterious hieroglyphs that have been puzzling Sydneysiders for decades. Since their discovery in 1970, the Gosford glyphs have generally been thought of as fake, graffiti done by university students or crazy farmers. But a small group of local enthusiasts of ancient Egypt swear to their authenticity. One local secondary school teacher, Stephen Strong, is said to be the authority on the Gosford glyphs. He and his brother Evan run a website called Forgotten Origin, which is said to document the ancient origins of humanity in Australia. I'm going to play you an excerpt from a YouTube video they've put up which explains their theory of the Gosford glyphs. So, according to the Strongs, the Gosford glyphs are evidence of the tragic journey of two young princes all the way from Egypt to the eastern shores of Australia. Their work documenting the glyphs is referred to by many advocates of the authenticity of the site. This work, however, has been disputed by many experts across Australia who are trained in Egyptology.
I mean, everyone would love it to be true. I mean, I wouldn't object either. I think it'd be fantastic if ancient Egyptians had got here, but sadly that's not the case.
That is the voice of Boya Okinga, who is an associate professor of ancient history at Macquarie University. He's been studying Egyptology for nearly 50 years and has conducted multiple expeditions to Egypt to examine the culture and artifacts firsthand. He says that although it would be amazing to have evidence of ancient Egyptian contact with Australia, he is yet to see any. Professor Okinga has been to view the Gosford glyphs firsthand, and he says that despite a few resemblances to authentic glyphs, they contain some fatal errors which prove they are fakes.
Well, I mean, they're supposed to be hieroglyphs, but in most cases they don't really make any sense.
Despite the sentiment of renowned Egyptologists like Professor Okinga, people like Stephen Strong maintain the carvings are real and detail the perilous journey of two Egyptian princes down under.
And I'll show you the story that is what I think is the most recent one.
And this right now you can hear Stephen talking people through the meaning of the glyphs. Stephen and Evan run tours of the carvings, and for $140, you can hear his detailed account of the meaning of the glyphs. The authenticity of the glyphs may be in the Strong's financial interest, and their explanation of their origins are not backed up by science.
This section here seems to be a story about what actually took place.
So, if the glyphs weren't the documentation of a treacherous journey from the shores of Egypt to the central coast of New South Wales, then why do they exist? Professor Okinga points to a 20th century obsession with ancient Egypt and first-hand contact between Australians and Egyptian artefacts as possible causes.
So, you know, this interest in Egypt has always been there. Here in Australia, of course, we also have the return of servicemen in the First World War who were stationed in Egypt and who encountered Egypt and its monuments at first hand, in particular, of course, the pyramids. You know, the Egyptian military camp was out at Giza. So a lot of the returned servicemen had this fascination for Egypt as well.
So whether the Gosford glyphs were carved by returning World War I soldiers, by local university students, or by ancient Egyptians, without being able to travel backwards in time, there is no definitive answer as to who created them or why. You will have to make up your own mind and go and visit the glyphs, which you can do for free if you have access to GPS. Tell us what you think, and don't have the wool pulled over your eyes.
And I would strongly recommend it to anyone. It's something well worth looking at. It's time to wake up, people. We've been lied to all our lives. The education system is a complete farce. This is an ancient tomb. And there's these types of sites all over Australia.
That story by Viktor Petrovich.
Razor's Edge, Sydney's independent news and current affairs radio on 2SER 107.3.
The Lebs, Michael Muhammad's first full-length fiction, picks up some years after his debut novella about a family of Lebanese Muslims, The Tribe, ended. Barney, the protagonist of both, is now a senior at Punchbowl Boys High, a school that once had a reputation for violence and anarchy. Andrew Popel has more.
Well, firstly, let's set up the context. So the book is set in the late 90s, and it's set in a real place, Punchbowl Boys High School, which is the high school that I went to. And the majority of the students at that school are from Arab-Australian Muslim backgrounds, which I, in the book, call Lebs for shorthand, which is a term that we were throwing around interchangeably with things like Middle Eastern, Arab and Muslim. Now, it just so happens that for any young Leb growing up in the western suburbs of Sydney between the years 1998 and 2005, you're going to be a little bit unlucky, because that's when the SCAF gang rapes took place in the year 2000, which turned pretty much every Arab-Australian Muslim male into a sexual predator in Australia. And then you had, in 2001, the September 11 attacks on New York City, which, in addition to the sexual predator stereotype, turned us all into terrorist suspects. And then by 2005, with the explosion of the Cronulla riots, the Arab-Australian Muslim male, the Leb, had basically become a folk devil. He was a drug dealer, gangster, drive-by shooter, then he was a sexual predator, then he was a terrorist suspect, and so on. And so that's the world that Bani Adam, the protagonist of this book, is living in as a teenage boy. Now, one of the problems with the way Arab-Australian Muslim men are usually represented and constructed in the mainstream media and in the political language, in political rhetoric, is extremely simplistic. It's very one-dimensional. We only play the part of the terrorist or the sexual predator or the gangster if you look at the historical representations of us, not just in Australia, but around the world. And so what I wanted to do in the Lebs is not give an alternative point of view, which is necessarily positive. I wanted to give a complex point of view, which gives both the strengths and weaknesses in our community and what it meant to be a Leb. And so now, to get to your point on the question of contradiction, Bani has contradictory thoughts all the time because he is a complex individual. Sometimes he can think in extremely homophobic, misogynist, violent ways, and other times he can think in extremely liberal, secular, progressive ways. Sometimes he's quoting great poetry, but in other times he's using it to justify utterly absurd ideas like pedophilia between him and his older teacher. So it's a complex portrayal of what it means to be a Leb. And I like to make the point that his name, Bani Adam, in Arabic means child of Adam or humankind. And so I was very explicit in giving him that name because I wanted him to represent humanity. And what it means to be a human being is a contradictory experience.
Bani's experience is very much circumscribed by the context you've just talked about. And there's a scene the day after September 11, 2001, when Bani's school is called to assembly. It's actually his year group are called to assembly. And the principal offers a particularly closed-minded opportunity for the students to discuss the events. Emerging from the discussion, we hear perspectives about America's complicity in the violence that it receives, and where is the sympathy, where is the empathy for people that die every day in conflict. This isn't a discussion that we hear broadly, if at all. How did you begin this for your writing, and where do we go with this discussion?
So look, you know, that would be one of the most complex and difficult scenes to comprehend in the Lebs, and it happens very early on, because the book starts around 1998, by about 30 pages in, you're in 2001, and it's the day of September 11. Now, for me growing up in the western suburbs of Sydney, among a large Muslim community, the first narrative that I wanted to put forward, which is a shocking narrative to a lot of Australians, but, you know, we just have to get past the denial about the situation and actually speak openly about it. For young Muslim men that I grew up around, it was a day of celebration. And so I wanted to write about that openly and explicitly. I didn't want to sugarcoat how the Lebs, the boys that I grew up around, were feeling the morning of 9/11 when they woke up, they turned on their televisions and they saw those planes flying into the buildings. And so when they went to school, they did not in any way hide their emotions. They were going out of their way, in fact, to show the teachers, who were primarily white, that they were jubilant about the event, about the incident, about those crimes. And so this is how it flips, because I wanted to give both points of view. So on the one hand, there's this narrative about Arab Muslim jubilation in the face of this tremendous act of terrorism. And then on the other hand, what happens is the school principal, and this happened in my reality, this actually happened at Punchbowl Boys, and I write about it as a fictional account of what actually happened. The principal had put the flag half-mast. And then he called my year group in particular up to the library to talk it through with us, because he felt that our group was the main group who were expressing a particular kind of sentiment which was distasteful, and he felt that he needed to talk it through. Now, this young boy in the book and in reality put up his hand, waited for a good hour to be allowed to speak, and finally he said that he felt there was a hypocrisy in the way in which the school expected us, who were primarily, us, the student body, who were primarily Arab Australian Muslim, to mourn this event, but never once in the history of us being at that school did the school show any sympathy for the thousands and in some cases millions of people who are related to us and connected to us through our ancestry that had been slaughtered in this conflict of East and West. And so I wanted to give both points of view. I wanted to give the point of view in the book of the horrendous jubilation that those boys were expressing, but also some kind of context for why they were articulating the particular sentiment that they were expressing. And, you know, I think that this is the hardest point and part for many Australians to comprehend, that the events of 9/11 are not a one-sided account. They're not unjustified acts of hate and terror, as the Bush administration was pushing. It had a lot to do with a long history of imperialism, colonialism, illegal occupation and invasion of Middle Eastern and Muslim countries. And I want to give a balanced point of view of both in the book.
We've just been talking about Bani. He's a keen observer of everyone that he comes past, the men that he observes in his life, both within his group and others. And I want to ask, is the phrase toxic masculinity, which we hear a lot now, I know I wasn't hearing that phrase in the late 90s, early 2000s, is it fair here? Because so many interactions in the Lebs are predicated by this perceived power imbalance between men and the women involved. And yet I thought the final scene actually turned that quite a bit on its head in the way that Bani plays that out and comes to a realisation.
Look, in the context of the Me Too movement, in the context of all the language that and rhetoric and politics that we're seeing at the moment, I think terms like toxic masculinity are very topical and are coming up a lot. There's all this kind of rhetoric that's being used to articulate the struggle. Look, the problem for me, as a person who identifies as brown, as Arab, as an Arab Muslim Australian man, is that quite often I can't escape particular constructions of masculinity. It's one of the historical issues with the way we construct the brown and black other, because there's a particular type of body. It's hairy, it's big, it's dark, it's seen as strong. When we think about the racist stereotyping of coloured men's genitalia, again, it's seen as hypersexual, hypermasculine. And so there is, for me, a danger in mixing up the language of masculinity with the language of patriarchy. Because for many, many men, particularly coloured men and working class men, they can never actually escape the masculinity that's built into their bodies. And there shouldn't be any shame in that. We should be able, men and women and everyone else, to embrace that which is masculine and see it in a beautiful way, separate from patriarchy. So I actually don't use terms like hypermasculinity and toxic masculinity. I use the term patriarchy. And if we're going to talk about patriarchy in the book, there's heaps of it. It's gross. The misogyny, the sexism, the patriarchal behavior of those young men that I grew up around is horrendous. But there is, I think, also moments of beautiful masculinity. And I try to give a kind of complex portrayal of both.
Can I say, I hope for a predominantly white readership of the Lebs, to read a book like this would have been so important for me at high school, to see not just representation outside my own culture from 100, 200, 1,000 years ago or in another country, but to see it within my own city. I would hope that readership.
I absolutely agree and appreciate what you're saying. I think that one of the biggest problems historically is not just that people of colour are constantly being pressured to read primarily white literature in school and university. And that's not a controversial thing to say. That's actually just standard curriculum if we look at what kids generally have to study. But also I think it's a way of reinforcing a narrow-minded way of looking at the world for people who would be identified as white, because it means that they don't get to experience just how beautifully diverse this country is and this world is. And it reinforces what important anthropologist from the University of Melbourne named Gus and Haj calls a fantasy of white supremacy. If all you're consuming as a white person or a person of colour is white literature, then it reinforces the illusion that whiteness is the superior position to be in throughout the world. And we've seen the devastating consequences of that throughout the world. I'm aware, you know, as a creative writer, I'm aware of some of the implications of the work that I've produced and some of the challenges and confrontation that people will face when they have to engage in this. But what I would like to point out is that this is a mirror. This book is a mirror of my reality. It's the mirror of a lot of people's realities, particularly young people of colour growing up in the western suburbs of Sydney. And that's something that I can't apologise for, something I'm very proud to say is now part of Australian literature.
Michael Muhammad Ahmed, ending that story by Andrew Popel. You can hear the chat with Andrew and Michael in its entirety over on 2SER's very own Final Draft. It's on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m, or you can go to our website 2SER.com and find the show there. Thanks for listening to Razor's Edge, Sydney's independent and local current affairs. You can catch us again next week from Thursdays at 7:30 p.m. or online at 2ser.com/razors-edge. I've been Miles Hobbrook-Walk. See you soon. Stay.